Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes, offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. The Florida Wildlife Federation, a private nonprofit conservation organization working on behalf of Florida's fish, wildlife, and their habitats, as well as outdoor education and sustainable nature-based recreation. The Florida Wildlife Federation, since 1936, fwfonline.org. And from Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys, Florida's advocates for seniors and persons with disabilities. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. More information about AFELA's policies at afela.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
A key change to a controversial gun bill involving places of worship and schools is causing more opponents to now sign up as supporters.
My critics and I share something very strongly in common. We want fewer people harmed by violence. We simply sometimes disagree on how that happens.
Also tonight, under a bill moving in the state Senate, illicit drug users wouldn't be arrested if they reported an overdose. The bill sponsor says expanding amnesty for onlookers would be a literal lifesaver.
I've said many times that I think we should be focused on less deaths, and I think that's what this bill really is the primary focus on to do.
We'll also witness the yin and yang between the two legislative chambers on the matter of higher education spending and sit down for a conversation with Florida Education Commissioner Pam Stewart. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. On last night's Capitol Report, we kicked off the show with a controversial gun bill. That same bill is back in the news tonight, so it's back in the program's opening slot. As you'll recall, that measure was drawing lots of fire from opponents. Supporters, meanwhile, were scrambling to see if there was anything that might change the minds of at least some of the naysayers. The, you'll pardon the expression, magic bullet was revealed today. With a new change, that bill has narrowly passed its first Senate committee, giving religious institutions the right to allow guns on their property if they're attached to a school. As Sasha Cordner reports, that's after it failed twice before in the same committee for the 2018 legislative session.
Under Ocala Republican Senator Dennis Baxley's original bill, places of worship with a school attached would have the right to allow concealed carry permit holders to have guns on the premises. It also applies to religious institutions that meet in a school. That's not the case today because guns are not allowed near or on the grounds of any Florida school. Now, under a new change, guns will not be allowed on the church property during normal school hours.
And the attempt is to try to clarify that and still have these congregations be able to form safety conditions so that they can stop an episode turning into a massacre. And so what we have done here is clarify when we're having church, we're good. When it's school day, then those conditions prevail.
But Florida League of Women Voters Stephanie Owens doesn't think the new change goes far enough. She says the bill still does not clearly prevent guns on the church premises that also have schools.
Additionally, the league believes that our places of worship should be gun-free, that people should be able to worship without guns in their presence. We also believe that individuals with concealed weapons don't possess the same training as law enforcement and therefore will not be effective in thwarting an active shooter in that regard.
Still, at least one gun control advocacy group is on board with the change.
My name is Kate Kyle. I'm a volunteer with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. And we would like to thank Senator Baxley and the members of this committee for working to ensure that this bill does not effectively allow guns in our children's schools when children are present or on college campuses at any time. So we support this amendment and we ask the lawmakers to vote in favor of it.
And Baxley's measure passed the Senate Judiciary Committee 6-4 with Democrats opposed. That's because this time the two South Florida Republicans who helped tank the bill in the past voted in favor of the Senate measure Thursday. But Hialeah Republican Senator Rene Garcia wanted some assurances from Baxley.
And I trust you're saying won't be initiated by you. My question is, if the House sends something back that does not meet the spirit of this committee's work, would you kill your own bill at that point, or would you go with the House's version?
So did Miami Republican Senator Anatoly Flores, who vowed to later vote down the bill if it's changed back to the House version or in any other way.
I would say agreeing to changes to what is in this bill now, I think would violate a certain level of trust that we have amongst each other as colleagues, as senators. And I know that's nothing that you would never do. And what we're hoping, and I know the rules chair is here as well, is that as we move forward, that it's important for us to deal with this specific issue and that other issues don't cloud that. Because if we can't get that commitment, then there might be a different vote.
Baxley says it's his hope to keep the bill as is. It's unclear if that change will show up in the House version of the bill, which passed its first committee Wednesday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Florida lawmakers want more people to be able to report a drug or alcohol overdose without fear of retaliation. The effort comes after the high-profile death of a college student, and as the state's opioid-related deaths continue to rise, we get that story from Kate Payne.
Senator Jeff Brandis, a St. Petersburg Republican, wants to prevent what he sees as senseless drug and alcohol-related overdoses.
Senators, in a majority of overdose situations, a friend or family member is present to intervene and save a life. However, when someone in America overdoses, a call for help occurs less than 50% of the time. And the primary reason a call is not made is due to fear of arrest or police involvement.
And there can be consequences.
Fear of losing public housing among people who inject drugs, fear of arrest, incarceration for outstanding warrants, or violating their parole or probation have also been cited as reasons for not calling 911 during an overdose event.
Florida already has a Good Samaritan law that provides some amnesty for people who are carrying drugs. But Brandis wants to expand it and shield users from arrest as well as charges. He wants to protect onlookers from the consequences, so they have no reason not to call 911.
So Senate Bill 970 extends immunity of arrest, including alcohol-related overdoses, and expands a list of crimes from which a person may receive immunity to include possession of alcoholic beverage by a person under 21, first-degree murder involving unlawful distribution of a controlled substance, and controlled substance or drug paraphernalia offense to someone who, in good faith, seeks help for someone who's experiencing an overdose.
Brandis says his measure is about saving lives. The effort comes after the alcohol-related death of Andrew Coffey, a student at Florida State University. He died in November at an off-campus fraternity party. According to a grand jury investigation, the fraternity members waited 11 minutes before calling 911 after they found Coffey unresponsive. FSU president and former state senator John Thrasher told reporters at the time that the culture has to change.
There will need to be a new normal for Greek life at the university. There must be a new culture for our students, and they must participate in creating that culture.
This also comes as the state's opioid-related deaths continue to climb. Here's Brandis again.
In 2016, we had almost 4,000 deaths related to the opioid crisis. With 10 Floridians losing their lives a day. I have said many times that I think we should be focused on less deaths, and I think that's what this bill really is the primary focus on to do.
With overdose reversal drugs like naloxone becoming more available, Brandis says the deaths are senseless, and it's something that's becoming an everyday occurrence for some first responders in the state. Wellington Democratic Representative Matt Wilhite is also a firefighter. He says the exposure to death and trauma is haunting.
But feel the effects on first responders and how they have to deal with that time after time after time.
just last year, lawmakers voted overwhelmingly to crack down on opioid dealers. Under the bill, which is now law, people who sell fentanyl, a powerful synthetic opioid, can be charged with first-degree murder when their users die of an overdose. At the time, Senator Dennis Baxley, a Lady Lake Republican, shared the thoughts of his son, who's a deputy sheriff.
Dad, could you please make sure they do something about this fentanyl? It is killing people. They're dropping dead everywhere. We can't go home without dealing with this. This is epidemic proportion. People who are selling this are tantamount to contributing to murders.
A year later, Brandis's Senate Bill 970 would protect those dealers from prosecution and arrest. At the time of this report, the Florida Sheriff's Association and the state's attorney general haven't taken a public stance on Brandis's bill. And so far, only one senator has voted against it, Republican Denise Grimsley of Lake Placid. The bill has one more committee stop before it heads to the Senate floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the complicated budget ballet to bring the House and Senate closer on higher education spending is underway.
The differences between the House and Senate are very manageable and expected and pretty routine.
And we'll find out how folks in the Florida Keys are faring after a long, long recovery process from Hurricane Irma.
Windows had leaks and a lot of roof leaks, a water surge. It was wet throughout. You know, we didn't know whether it had come up through the bottom or off the top.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
In the Florida legislature right now, the Senate wants to spend more money on higher education, while the House wants to make cuts. It's still early, but the leaders of the legislature are hundreds of millions of dollars apart on state university funding. From member station WLRN in Miami, Jessica Bakeman reports they are downplaying the gap between their budget proposals as formal negotiations are set to begin.
The board that oversees public higher education in Florida meets with university presidents every other month. And this week, they were in Tallahassee. So Senate President Joe Negron and House Speaker Richard Corcoran left the Capitol and stopped by Florida State University to address them. The legislative leaders were full of mutual praise.
I want to thank Speaker Corcoran, who's been an incredible partner.
There has probably been no better friend to the higher education system in the history of the state than President Negron.
Corcoran made it sound like he was firmly behind his counterpart's top priorities, increasing funding to universities and student financial aid programs.
We are 100% supportive. Of course I'm going to support that.
But that's not what the House budget proposal reflected when it was unveiled earlier in the week. Corcoran's deputies are making an argument for cutting funding to higher ed. In South Florida, that includes Florida International University in Miami and Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. Representative Larry Ahern chairs the House Higher Education Budget Committee. During a recent meeting, he called public higher education in Florida overfunded.
The slowing of growth in this silo is both reasonable and necessary.
Ahern pointed out that universities aren't required to give back any taxpayer money they don't spend, so he says they have too much money in their reserves.
It just piles up there.
His committee proposed cutting universities by $217 million and urging them to drain their savings accounts to fill any gaps. The proposed cuts come after a particularly good year for universities, when Negron successfully got them big increases. And now the Senate is proposing another big increase to the tune of $187 million. So the Senate and House are pretty far apart on higher education funding, but leaders balk at the suggestion that they'll struggle to bridge the gap. Senate President Joe Negron and House Speaker Richard Corcoran have been through this many times before. They both chaired appropriations committees in the Florida legislature before taking on their current roles. Here's Negron.
In my experience working on the budget, the differences between the House and Senate are very manageable and expected and pretty routine.
The legislature is really just starting the budget negotiation process. Session is slated to end on March 9th. Committees have started releasing their early proposals. Soon, each chamber will vote on its respective spending plan. And then there will be a series of meetings, in public and behind closed doors, where lawmakers will make offers and trades until they come to a final compromise. So what Negron gets for universities will depend on what he's willing to give for Corcoran's priorities. And Corcoran has focused on promoting charter schools, vouchers, and other alternatives to K-12 public schools. This is Corcoran.
We are well poised to finish on time and to accomplish great things in both higher ed and K-12. I wouldn't read more into the budgets than that.
Lawmakers typically fight less over the budget in an election year because they want to get back home to campaign. Corcoran is widely expected to run for Florida governor, and he says things will go smoothly this year.
A smooth session is coming out with great outcomes for the people of the state.
Last session went into overtime because lawmakers were arguing over major education policy changes tied to the budget. Legislative leaders shoved their biggest priorities into two bills, each about 300 pages long. The bills were published at the last minute, and one ended up getting vetoed. The other barely passed, and now school districts are suing over it. After all that, Governor Rick Scott also vetoed part of the education budget and forced lawmakers back to Tallahassee for a special session. But looking back on negotiations over the 2017 budget, House Speaker Richard Corcoran says,
last year, I think they went smoothly.
I'm Jessica Bakeman in Tallahassee.
Florida Education Commissioner Pam Stewart has lots of ideas on lots of different educational topics. Florida Public Radio's Kim Kelling sat down to chat with the commissioner about those ideas.
Do you think that the community colleges should be moved out of the Department of Education?
I absolutely do not, and it does not have anything to do with me personally. As I said, I'll be exiting in the next year. It has to do with efficiency, that seamless nature that exists in the K-12 to higher ed world, and it has to do with not wanting to grow government.
I wanted to get your update on where you think things are going with Jefferson County, since it's our one fully charter school district. So, you know, they've been at it now for a while. What's happening over there?
The community has embraced what's happening in Jefferson County. We heard some student and parent and some of the board and some from the charter company come and speak to the legislature and provide an update. And I think that we've provided for the citizens of Jefferson County something that has been needed there for a long time. And I think when you do that and when you put that much effort into something, it inspires those in the community, and I think they are rallying behind, and I think that those students are getting something that they've not been able to get for a long time.
So looking at, you know, these rural schools like Jefferson County, and there are many other very rural school districts, how do we support school districts that have, you know, limited tax base to pull from and how they finance their schools? And I mean, these are real challenges for a state like Florida.
I think it is a challenge for a rural community to be able to be everything for that community. I think that there are structures in place to be able to support small districts. We have great examples of small districts who perform very, very well. By nature of being small, they are top heavy. Mm-hmm. And looking at ways that they can expedite some of those services by using their consortium more, I think those are ways that they can, in fact, find the success that other rural districts that did not find themselves in the situation Jefferson did. I don't think we have to go to a charter situation in order to be successful in rural districts. I think there are other ways for them to be able to accomplish they've done.
Then looking then at our private schools, so you have charters, you have privates, you have public. How do we make sure that our public schools stay viable for all of our students? We don't have a pulling away of some of our students to go to private schools because they perceive public schools as having too many rules or too many assessments.
I think there will always be a place for public school, maybe because that's my heart, providing choice among public schools, whether it's charter or we have in almost every district, we have a choice program where they can choose to attend a school that offers a program that they are particularly interested in. I think all those things make public education more appealing, more viable, and competition is good for all of us to reflect and step up our game. And so I think there will always be a place for what we call our traditional public schools, but they are changing.
Right. Well, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us.
Florida Public Radio's Kim Kelling speaking with Florida Education Commissioner Pam Stewart. More legislative developments now from Bob Brooks at our sister operation, the Florida Channel.
We're nearing the end of the third week of session, and here are some of the bills passing through committees today. Senate Bill 1598, sponsored by Senator Kathleen Passidomo. The Uniform Deployed Parents Custody and Visitation Act. It provides requirements regarding custodial responsibility of a child of a service member. It authorizes a court to grant caretaking authority or limited contact to a non-parent under certain conditions, and it provides for the termination of a grant of authority. It also authorizes a court to modify or terminate a temporary grant of custodial responsibility. SB 1598, with a committee substitute, was voted favorably by the House Judiciary Committee and has two more committee stops before going to the floor. House Bill 63, entitled Students with Disabilities in Public Schools. This bill provides requirements for using seclusion, restraint, and exclusionary and non-exclusionary time. It revises school district policies and procedures and requires continuing education and in-service training relating to students with certain disabilities. The bill was voted favorable by the House Education Committee and placed on the calendar for second reading. House Bill 7017, Child Exploitation. This bill criminally prohibits persons in Florida from possessing, promoting, viewing, or transmitting morphed child pornography or using children in a sexual performance. HB 7017 passed the Judiciary Committee and now heads to the full House. And finally, House Bill 365, Standards for Corrections Officers. Currently, a person must be 19 years old to become a corrections officer. However, if HB 365 becomes law, that age will be reduced to 18 with the limitation that they will not be able to supervise inmates. They will, though, be able to perform all other tasks. Today, the bill passed the House Judiciary Committee and now heads to the full House. From the Florida Channel, I'm Bob Brooks for Florida Public Radio.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, let's step away from the Capitol in Tallahassee for a few moments, far removed from the bustle, political posturing, lobbying, and all the other activity associated with the annual lawmaking. Our destination, that part of Florida that extends well out into that place where the waters of the Caribbean and the Atlantic mingle. In a lot of ways, life has returned to normal in most of the Florida Keys, but one major institution, a hospital, is still operating out of temporary quarters after Hurricane Irma. From member station WLRN, Nancy Klinger reports that for the Middle Keys, the road to a return of a full hospital is looking long and expensive.
It was the first time that Baptist Health has ever actually closed a hospital for a hurricane.
Rick Freeberg is the chief executive officer of Fisherman's Hospital in Marathon. He's been with Baptist Health South Florida for 30 years.
I feel like the captain walking away from a ship that's sinking and didn't like it, but mandatory evacuation means mandatory evacuation.
So he evacuated, and when he came back,
the building looked pretty much the same, just externally driving up. I was hoping that it had been maybe damaged a little more than what it appeared to be.
That sounds odd coming from the hospital's CEO. But Freeberg had only been in that position for just over 2 months. Baptist took over Fisherman's in July, and he already knew Fisherman's needed a major overhaul. His disappointment didn't last, though.
Once we got inside, there was a whole lot more damage than you could see from looking at it from the outside.
The whole hospital was soaked.
Windows had leaks and a lot of roof leaks, water surge. It was wet throughout. You know, we didn't know whether it had come up through the bottom or off the top.
Fisherman's came back 2 weeks after Irma, but not to the building that first opened in 1962. There's a temporary field hospital in the parking lot now. It's basically an emergency room with a few other services available.
We're saving lives. We are. We're seeing between 30, maybe 40 patients a day.
People who need longer-term care are either taken to Mariners Hospital in the Upper Keys, which is also run by Baptist, or a Baptist hospital on the mainland in Miami-Dade. Only about 10,000 people live in the Middle Keys. You wouldn't normally have a hospital for a community that size. Keys geography means if Fisherman's Hospital weren't there, it would be an hour-long drive to the nearest emergency room. Bruce Schmidt moved to the Middle Keys with his family when he was a kid in the 1950s, and eventually, he served on the board of Fisherman's. He remembers when people first started talking about building a hospital there.
We had an airport. We had an elementary school, had a high school, had a country club, but we did not have a hospital.
The community got federal funding, but had to match it with local dollars.
Every business had a little jar for donations. There were kids going door to door collecting money. I remember doing that myself, actually. There was a billboard on the side of the road with a big thermometer, so you drive by the billboard where the hospital is today, you could see where the level of funds were.
Rebuilding Fisherman's after Irma is going to take a bigger thermometer. Freeburg, the CEO, says the estimates range from $25 million if they renovate the old building to $40 million for a whole new facility. That's a pretty big bill for a small community. So many people in Marathon are especially grateful that the merger with Baptist went through when it did.
I feel for Baptist.
Sarah Mathis has lived in the Middle Keys for 25 years.
They bought a hospital that 6 or 8 weeks later didn't work anymore, and that's a bad position to be in.
The first time she used Fisherman's was when her daughter fell against a coffee table and gashed her head. The second time, the patient was Mathis herself.
I was bitten by a poisonous snake.
Mathis says having a hospital in Marathon is crucial for emergency medical care and to have an option for people to be near friends and family when they're sick.
So that's not only, you know, bringing you flowers, but also making sure that your medical case is being managed well without the added burden of finding a hotel room in Miami to stay overnight and be able to be at the hospital bedside of a loved one.
She said it's also important economically.
It's a source of good jobs. The majority of the jobs in the Keys are all tourism related, and those don't always mean high paying jobs unless you are a business owner.
Before Irma, there were about 200 people who worked for Fisherman's Hospital in the associated medical offices. That number's been cut almost in half. Baptist is waiting for information from insurers and FEMA before deciding whether to renovate the old hospital or build a new one. In the meantime, they've signed a contract to move modular hospital units to the Middle Keys that will provide more local services than the current field hospital. I'm Nancy Klinginer in Key West.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank Jessica Bakeman, Kim Kelling, Nancy Klinginger, and our sister operation, the Florida Channel. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2018 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes, offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. The Florida Wildlife Federation, supporting acquisition, protection, and stewardship of public and private conservation lands to protect Florida's waters, and to Everglades restoration and fish and wildlife conservation. The Florida Wildlife Federation, fwfonline.org. And from Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys, Florida's advocates for seniors and persons with disabilities. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. More information about AFELA's policies at afela.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.